Baseball America College podcast time. Jacob Rudner, Peter Flaherty, we're back for yet another episode of our favorite show. And I will start by saying that we are excited that this is the penultimate college baseball podcast in which we are in our every other week format. We got one more show in December after this one. And then from then on, we will be back to Tuesday publishing. We will be going once a week. It is the season time, Peter, in college baseball land. So a lot to be excited about. We're about 2 months away from the start of college ball, maybe a little bit more than that. And now we're going to really put a pin in the off season with, I think, this episode as we start to move forward and look towards 2026.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I know it feels weird to say sitting here on December 9th and on the day of this recording and the day of the release, as we're in like full handbook mode, but the college season is slowly, perhaps not so slowly, kind of creeping up. I always, at least in my head, what it's always felt like is we have this little stretch of the holidays for the next few weeks, and then the calendar flips to the new year, and then it's more or less pedal to the metal from January through June 20 something, depending on whether or not the College World Series final goes two or three games, because after that practices start, you've got stuff to talk about every week, and then we got games. So it's right on the horizon. It's a very fun time of year for a number of reasons, but we're getting there.
No, we really are. And just to kind of give people a look at that calendar, exactly right now, we're in that winter transfer portal period. So to me, this kind of marks the end of the fall winter season, whatever you want to call it. That goes until December 15th. After that, like Peter said, we all kind of break for the holidays, and then we get back, and the American Baseball Coaches Association has its annual convention. This year it's January 8th in Columbus, Ohio. Peter and I will be there with coverage of those couple days. Always a fun little event that happens to kind of kick off the year. And then, as Pete said, teams return. For the most part, everybody's back on campus by about January 8th, 9th. And now with this extended ramp up period for the regular season, teams are working out. And then before we know it, it'll be February 13th when it is opening day. And Peter and I will be spread across the country for the following 5 months after that, following what we believe to be the greatest horse race on the planet. Today, though, Peter, to kind of really put a close to the fall, we are going to go through our Fall Ball All-Stars piece. For those of you who missed it, again, I would encourage you, just in general, head on over to baseballamerica.com, but in particular, baseballamerica.com/college, and there you will find our 2025 College Baseball Fall Ball All-Stars. Now, I want to clarify something here before we really even get into this at all, and shout out to now Oakland Athletics, simply the Athletics prospect, Colby Halter, former Florida infielder Colby Halter, who reached out to me after the publishing of this story to challenge the notion of fall All-Americans. This is not that. This is not an awards article. What this is was kind of a look at who's done well this fall, who made velo gains if you're a pitcher, who made mechanical changes, who was a really tough out at the plate, who maybe made a swing change that was notable. This was an intel series of 14 players who we thought stood out based on the feedback that we had received. So importantly, what Peter and I are about to discuss is not some sort of All-American show. This is fully intel and feedback from the fall that we found encouraging or intriguing for some reason. And with that being said, I wanted to quickly, before we start talking about players, talk about this. The feedback gathering process for us. What exactly does that look like for you, Peter? How does it work in terms of gaining fall intel? But I guess more broadly speaking, when people look at our draft coverage, for example, and we have write-ups and we have updates throughout the year about star players and not so star players, guys, we're going to fill out the rest of the 20 rounds. What is your process like? Where are the avenues that you are pursuing in order to get feedback that qualifies for the things that we do at Baseball America when it comes to scouting the amateur side?
Yeah, I have a feeling we'll overlap on most, if not all, of this stuff. But I guess, I try my best, just as everyone does at BA, to win the process and therefore win the evaluation. So by that, I mean, essentially turning over every stone that I can. I think first and foremost, I watch a certain player a number of times. If I'm able to get out and see that player in person, obviously sink my teeth into them and get a few looks, mostly as it pertains to any player in the Northeast or on the Cape, bearing down on guys throughout the summer, but in the off season and guys that I can't get to see in person, it's diving into every video that I've got access to and synergy and, you know, using and trusting my eyes, but at the same time, also talking to, you know, that guy's coaches or, you know, other evaluators and scouts who have seen them, asking for, you know, asking a number of people their opinion and what they've thought of a certain player, and then doing my best at the end to kind of blend all of those things together and, you know, sort of form as, I guess, I don't want to say as educated an opinion, but, you know, as thorough an evaluation on a certain player. Now, at the end of the day, like, I don't think anyone at BA like really needs their like hand held through the process being like, you know, asking other people what they might think of Rock Chalowski or a certain player and basing their opinion off of that. You know, we're not just like a mouthpiece for anyone, but I think it really does help when you're tightening up loose ends and trying to find the last few pieces to a puzzle. And maybe, you know, again, just making it as thorough as in depth as possible and using all of the resources that you have available, you know, gathering all of these opinions and doing the thorough and adequate reporting. So that was kind of a long-winded way of saying that, you know, very fortunate enough to use all of the resources at our disposal and certainly take advantage of all of that. And I think at the end, and it's reflected in our rankings and our reports and, you know, a lot of aspects of what we do, I think that it ends up, you know, you get a really, really thorough look at who a player is, whether they're in college, high school, junior college, no one that shows up on our draft board, whether they're ranked number one or 500, there is no lapse in thoroughness throughout the rankings.
No, and we also do have the opportunity, I think, while we are not a mouthpiece, and I like how you said that, there is an opportunity for us to kind of demonstrate the scope of opinions on a player, which happens every single year with nearly every single player, because we are talking to so many different, whether it's scouts or cross checkers or scouting directors or analysts, who are getting looks at players and studying them in terms of what they see on video or in person or via the data. And they put all that together, and people who are making decisions in front offices have widely differing opinions from even some of their own colleagues, let alone teams, you know, other teams. And I think that we are in a unique position to kind of triangulate where the industry stands on a certain prospect. One more thing that I'll add, and that was really interesting for us this fall, was getting feedback from coaches directly. If you were paying attention to the Baseball America website over the course of the last 2 months, one thing that we did was this fall ball intel series where at least once a week for the last, you know, 9 weeks, we were doing a series of updates on teams from around the country and how they were performing in the fall, how their prospects were performing in the fall. And all of that, most of that, was the byproduct of conversations directly with that team's head coach. So when we're writing about Tyler Minnick and UConn, that came directly after a conversation with Jim Penders, who said, hey, listen, my guy Tyler Minnick, who had great stats last year, who scouts are on and really like, which we can verify with conversations with scouts and analysts, has had a great fall. He's playing center field. He's got a little bit of a wrist injury that he's going to have cleaned up, but it will be ready for preseason camp. That's directly from the coach. And so one thing that was important throughout this fall ball, you know, all-stars, if you want to call it that, process, was getting direct feedback from the people who are watching these players the most, which is objectively their coaches, because we are not at practices as much as the coaches are, nor are the scouts. And so it was interesting to hear some very honest feedback from the managers of these teams and getting a better understanding of what they thought. So that's another aspect, in my opinion, that kind of goes into our feedback process. With that being said, the loudest recipient of feedback this fall, in my opinion, and you know, feel free to disagree, and this is from the professional side in terms of evaluators watching this player. This was directly from Dave Van Horn, This was a sweeping win for this player over the course of the fall, and that's Arkansas catcher Ryder Helfrich. There is a battle for the top college catcher in this 2026 draft class. I think that it really centers around three names: Georgia Tech's Von Lackey, Texas Carson Tinney, and Ryder Helfrich. If Helfrich didn't make up significant ground, if not take the lead this fall, I don't know what he did, because he apparently was outstanding. I'll read a quote from Dave Van Horn before letting you talk about Helfrich here a little bit. This is directly from him. It's on our website. He's a first-round pick in my book, and quite frankly, I'll have questions about whoever disagrees with that if they saw him this fall. There's nothing he can't do on the field. He calls his own game. He hits for power. He doesn't swing and miss. We couldn't get him out. I've had plenty of first-rounders here. I know what they look like. He's as good as any of them. We haven't had a player look this good in the fall since Heston Kerstad, and he went pretty good. So very loud praise from a coach who I don't think dishes that out very freely. What have you been hearing about Ryder Helfrich in what has seemingly become the fall of Ryder?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like by everything that we've heard and have been able to gather, and obviously from Coach Van Horn, like that's as high a praise as you can get in Fayetteville, being comp to someone like Heston Kerstad, big leaguer, and, you know, went third overall. I mean, if he goes out this spring and does it, I think that's the X factor for a lot of these, or some of these guys, in the fall. If he goes out and replicates kind of what he did last year as a sophomore, which was hit over 300 with 15 homers, you know, he'll certainly be in the conversation to be the first catcher off the board, first college catcher at that. But he's a strong physical kid, plus bat speed and kind of a pull oriented approach with plus power to the pull side. He didn't show any issue getting to it in game, whether it was as a freshman on the Cape. I think he led the Cape in homers. And then last spring, obviously. So, I mean, he's not a kind of a metal bat wonder, so to speak, but you know, this fall, it's encouraging that, you know, what Coach Van Horn said was that he didn't swing and miss a whole lot, 'cause that was a little bit of a bugaboo last year. I think that his overall contact rate was sub 70% and his zone contact was sub 80. So, I mean, that's awesome that he swung the bat well this fall against Arkansas's arms, which are, you know, it's a really talented group. But, you know, I think that's why, you know, the fall, not to go on a separate sort of tangent, you have to note what you're seeing and recognize what's happening and evaluate it. But I think it's important to know how much to weigh that, because, you know, guys are, you know, beating up for the most part, like on their roommates and like closest friends. So, I mean, it's an if for some of these guys, if they can do it in the spring, but if Helfrich does, I mean, he'll be right there. So, I mean, if he can shore up the hit tool a little bit and carry over what sounds like this, it's been a step forward into the spring and put the ball in play more, that's only going to benefit him. And picking up shapes and seeing spin out of the hand as well, which is kind of the root of the hit tool question mark. You know, the most, if not, you know, the vast majority of his swing and miss comes against secondaries. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if that takes a step forward, but the defense is trending in the right direction. But he's a power first, power oriented bat. And that kind of profile, I mean, if he's a high level performer in the SEC at a premium position, that in and of itself doesn't really last that long. So certainly someone that's trending in the right direction. And it seems like it's starting to all come together for him. So it's great to hear from Coach Van Horn.
A couple notable numbers that you referenced there. Last year, he didn't chase a ton, 21.3% chase rate, which is actually fairly reasonable. The questions that you highlighted, though, overall contact rate was 69.8%, zone contact rate just 78.3%, both of those numbers well below average. But he did have very good angles when he hit the ball hard. Also, he did hit the ball hard, 87.2 mile per hour average exit velocity, 106 mile per hour, 90th percentile. So we are talking about somebody with the tools to be a good hitter. The one thing I'll add, the defense apparently took a step forward this fall, which is a really big deal for catchers. Guys who can stick behind the plate have a lot more runway to be able to kind of figure things out. And it seems like Helfrich is in a position to be that. He calls his own games, as Dave Van Horn said. The receiving has apparently gotten a lot smoother. He's starting to steal a little bit more strikes on the fringes, which I think was something that evaluators wanted to see more of last year. So we're talking about somebody who may be able to play average, if not slightly above defense. He's got a good arm while being a productive hitter at that position. That's a really good combo. And by the way, the totality of the skills is something that I think we are looking for still in that number one catcher race to kind of figure out who might be the first catcher off the board from the college ranks. Let's talk about another position, a little bit less defensive value. By that, I mean a lot. First baseman Brady Ballinger, Pete, at Kansas, is somebody who has really caught my attention this fall just in doing a little bit more deep diving on the data, but also in the feedback. The feedback has been outstanding. I've had a couple evaluators tell me that they had second or third round grades on him. Last year, he was one of very few hitters to accomplish these statistical categories. I will read them for you here. Last season, only three Division I players hit the following marks: an average exit velocity of at least 89 miles per hour, a 90th percentile EV of 106 miles per hour or higher, a barrel rate above 30%, a zone contact rate above 85%, and an overall contact rate above 80%. That group included UT Arlington's Tyce Armstrong, UCLA shortstop and 2026 number one overall prospect, Rock Chalowski, and Brady Ballinger from Kansas. I know you like him too. Where does he stack up in the preseason mix as we head into the spring, especially after, you know, there was a lot of loud feedback from his fall in terms of being more aggressive at the plate, which was something that people wanted to see, and just continuing to demonstrate that he has the strength and contact ability to be a well above average hitter?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. As far as draft range for me right now, he fits in the second to fourth round, probably third round if you want to get more specific and whittle it down a little bit. But, you know, as also you laid out, it's a really enticing hit power blend. You kind of, you not throw the position entirely out the window, but, you know, you're drafting Brady for the bat and the offensive ability. And it's a well-rounded offensive profile. You know, it's a above average bat to ball skills, consistently on the barrel. As you said, his barrel rate last year was almost 33%. He can drive the baseball from gap to gap. And to kind of add to his hit ability, you know, he's got really sound pitch recognition skills. He chased last year just a 20% clip. And really good swing decisions, and only a handful of his swings, at least when looking at synergy, came out of like the quote unquote shadow zone. So I guess you call that competitive pitches or, you know, whatever, but the swing decisions were really polished. You know, you could pretty easily argue a 55 on the hit tool and an easy 50 on the power. And that's probably on the more conservative side. So, I mean, as you said, it's, you know, when poking holes or when looking to kind of poke holes in guys, it gets increasingly difficult with Ballinger. Like the 90th percentile EV last year was a shade over 106. Hard hit percentage at right on the nose at 50. We cited the barrel rate already. Chase rate was a tick over 20%. Really good contact skills, solid angles. I guess the sort of the one thing that could maybe serve him well, but you know, it certainly wasn't a hindrance, and this was an approach that paid off for him last year. If he gets a little bit more aggressive on pitches like in his go zone or nitro zone, but again, we're talking about a guy that hit over 350 last year with 16 homers and 21 doubles. Like, I wouldn't really, this is kind of a classic case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Cause I mean, you know, unless there's something glaring that you know, the coaching staff sees that they want to change, this is a guy that I wouldn't touch right now and just kind of let him rock out and do his thing.
Well, just to reiterate, you know, Kansas and several evaluators did say that they wanted to see him be more aggressive on pitches in his go zone. Last year, heart swing rate was 69.4%, zone ring swing rate just 59.1%, overall 36.6. It is on the lower side. I don't know that you'd call it passive with results like that, but it is certainly very selective, and maybe being a little bit less, you know, strict on the swing decisions could be something. And the feedback out of the fall, this is what I was really going at. The feedback out of the fall is that he was able to do that, and it didn't come at the cost of, losing the discipline in terms of the chase rate, being able to make a lot of contact with authority, I should add. It sounds like he was able to continue to refine his physical condition. He's stronger. He's a year older. The angles, as you cited already, were very good last year. And so if he can be a little bit more aggressive, which, you know, granted, it is against pitchers who he's most familiar with because he lives with them and eats with them and hangs out with these guys. But, you know, if it can hold into the spring, this to me is somebody who has sky-high potential in terms of draft position, just given that he's a very advanced bat and there aren't a lot of guys who check the same boxes that he does.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think when all is said and done, he's probably not a guy that I'd use my first pick on, but depending on how he does and depending on, you know, if I'm an organization and where I'm picking, I could see him, you know, going in the second round. Like, that's probably his ceiling draft wise. It's tough to really stick a ceiling on him until you actually watch what he does this spring. But realistically, second round ceiling, but I'd fully expect him to be gone probably by the fourth round or so. Like, it's going to be really tough to keep on passing on the bat.
Let's now talk about a player who you can put a ceiling on. That's Rock Chalowski. We couldn't get through this podcast without talking about Rock. And just so you know, if you're a fan of the College Baseball Podcast, get used to it, because we're going to be talking about this dude a whole lot this year. Peter, slow me down if you must, but this is the best college hitting prospect that we've seen, in my opinion, since the Dansby Swansons, Alex Bregmans, Troy Tulowitzkis of the, like, this is that caliber hitting prospect right now. I would roughly estimate, and I'm going to give a very wide range here, that if and when he is drafted first overall, he will enter pro ball immediately as somewhere between a top 10 and, let's just say, to be very generous and safe, 25 prospect in the game right out the gate. This is an advanced player in every single respect. The defense is buttery smooth. He makes a ton of contact. He hits the ball hard. The angles are good. There are not a lot of questions about his game. If you're going to poke holes in the offseason, it is certainly that over the summer when he had a wood bat in his hands, it was not terribly productive with Team USA. But again, he was our College Player of the Year last year as a sophomore. He is the runaway favorite going into the season to win College Player of the Year again. And I will add, we have never had back-to-back College Player of the Year winners in the history of baseball America. That is a now four-decade-plus history. And so we're talking about somebody who's in a very rare position and has the skills to match. What is the expectation for you with Rock Chalowski going into this year? And I would also say this, you know, let's play the opposite game. We're going to talk a lot about the positives of players in this podcast. What are you keeping an eye on from a concern standpoint? Are there holes in the game that you're going to try and keep an eye on here? What are the indicators you're looking for to see progress from Rock?
As far as holes go, this is perhaps as difficult a player to poke a hole in probably in this year's class. I mean, on both sides of the baseball, the defense with him as the calling card, it's no doubt plus defense at shortstop for reasons that we've hit on at length, both, you know, on the website. Our Carlos Collazo did a fantastic piece that went in depth on every part of Chalowski's game that's up on the website that I'd highly recommend checking out. But yeah, I mean, as far as a whole, like, there isn't really like one area to circle where it's like, you know, I really hope that he makes progress in this area. Like, I mean, you mentioned, like, if there's one nitpick, it's the lack of summer performance. But last year with USA, like, when looking at the team that went over to Japan, and I think they went 0-5 or 1-4 or whatever, but nobody hit, and that's not giving, you know, a pass for a bad performance, but I think it's important context. And it's also, we're looking at a 18 to 20 at bat sample. Like, it's really difficult to put that much stock into it. So I guess, like, it's a little bit of a cop-out answer, but seeing, you know, if he can keep it rolling from last spring, and seeing if he can sustain that sort of production. And I fully expect him to. I mean, as a freshman, he hit, you know, over 300 with over 20 extra base hits, and then he went out and did what he did last spring, which was hit over 350 with 23 homers and 74 RBIs, started lifting the baseball more to the pull side, and you know, that paid dividends.
Historically successful.
Yeah, so I mean, if he can, setting the bar at what he did last year is almost unfair just because of how exceptional he was. But I mean, if he can, to an extent, kind of replicate that level of impact and production, I think that that will serve him well. And I, until he proves me otherwise, like, I have no reason to believe that he won't be able to do it. You know, the defense is the defense, but the offense took a real step forward last year. Whether it was the hit ability and then also the impact, it was really, really impressive as it gets. So, I mean, it's, you know, he's the leader in the clubhouse for a reason. Like, as far as the 1-1 conversation goes, I think it's pretty fair to say at this point that, you know, it's his slot to lose. And now a lot could change and a lot will change between now and the draft. But, you know, I think, and this is what I thought of just instantaneously, but, you know, I'll be really interested to see how he performs with, like, essentially every spotlight in the world and all of this buzz going on around him. Like, everyone knew who Rock Chalowski was coming out of Hamilton High School. We had top 2-round interest there, and, you know, seeing how he would do as a freshman, like, you know, why'd he turn down millions of dollars? Like, this is kind of an interesting decision. Let's see how he does at UCLA. Goes out and does what he did as a freshman, did that as a sophomore, but now it's like, you know, he's the 1-1 favorite, Golden Spikes favorite, National Player of the Year favorite. Like, all eyes are on him. There's a huge target on his back, and the expectations are sky high. And I'm really excited to see how he performs when the lights are at their brightest. And I think that's going to say a whole lot. And if he goes out from and does what he did, or close to what he did from a production standpoint last year, I think that's only going to enhance my opinion on him as a player, because going out and doing it with a huge target on your back like that, and when the outside noise is at, like, volume 100, I think that speaks volumes just about a player's makeup and what they got going on in between the ears.
Does a player like that stand to lose something on the draft status or upside front if you don't outperform what you did as a sophomore? Like, does a player like Chalowski, and this is a conversation somewhat in the abstract, but does a player like Chalowski have to go out and improve the back of the baseball card numbers? Or if you are within the ballpark of what you did last year, like, let's say last year he hit over 350. What happens if he hits 330 with 19 homers and it's not the 20 plus, it's not 350? What does that do to the player? Because you ask me, it should be nothing. We know what Rock Chalowski is, and some marginal movement in either direction, better or worse, should not change the profile. But I guess my question is, does there exist risk or potential volatility in his draft profile if he isn't able to replicate or improve upon last year?
I mean, I think if he goes out and, like, you know, really struggles, like, certainly that could change things. But is, and we talk about this all the time with players, where, like, the discussion of performance versus tools, and, you know, a guy going in a certain spot because in the draft, because of, you know, how you perform, and guys like that only have so high of a ceiling because, you know, oftentimes you're talking about the performance instead of the tools. And on the other side, you're talking about guys going in a certain range because of their tools and maybe the performance is lacking. But with Rock, like, it's this blend of both. And we all know the tools at this point. You know, he's done it for 2 years, and last year was super, super loud. So, I mean, unless, like, you know, you got to use your eyes. I think it's, you know, really important, you know, in watching the player. So, I mean, if he goes out and hits even the 320 to 330 with 17 to 15 to 19 homers, like, that's not going to change anything. So, I mean, if there's, like, a markedly, if he's, like, I'm trying to word this correctly and I'm in a concise and succinct way, but if, like, the how it looks with Rock looks different than what it did last year in a negative way, like, that, you know, maybe you kind of dig in a little bit further. But, like, if what he is doing on both sides of the baseball looks the same, process-wise in the box. The approach for the most part is the same. The impact and batted ball data, I have no reason to believe it's going to back up to a drastic degree. Like, the approach looks the same. The defense is obviously not going to back up. He's a comfortably plus defender at the most premium position on the field. Like, if everything looks the same with how he's doing it, the opinion on him will remain unchanged. And like, the stats are just going to be the stats, if that makes sense.
It does. And I guess the other question is, how much can his defense be a carrying tool in this situation? Like, is there room for his bat to back up that maybe another top offensive prospect in a draft year, like, let's go back to 2024, Travis Bezzana is the first overall pick in that draft. If his offense took a step in the wrong direction as a junior and he's a second baseman, maybe there's not as much room for that. Whereas a guy like Rock is, I mean, I was at the scrimmage between UCLA and UC Irvine this fall. I was sitting in the scouting section. The guy who I was sitting next to looks at me and goes, you know, it's easy seven defense for me on a guy like Rock Chulowski. That's double plus defense. Do I think that it's there? Not necessarily. And that's one guy's feedback. But the fact that that notion exists within the community, I think, is really telling. So my question to you is, can he afford, not that you want this, but can he afford to not have the same offensive season this year as he did last year, play the defense that we know he's capable of, and still not have a problem in the draft because of that defensive performance?
I think the defense for him serves as a really, I guess, comforting anchor / foundation to the profile. I mean, whether it's this year's draft or in any draft in years past, I mean, you're talking about a slam dunk plus defender at shortstop who is going to be an impact defender at the position through professional baseball. And there are zero questions about him sticking there. So, I mean, when talking about him compared to other guys in this year's class and even in years past, you can't really say that about a whole lot of players on a year-to-year basis that, like, yes, this dude is a plus defender at shortstop. Now he is going to stick there as he progresses through pro ball. He's going to have the same level of impact defensively as he goes and kind of, you know, ascends through professional baseball. Like, that in and of itself puts him in a pretty exciting and enticing bucket. So I think it definitely plays in his favor. And, you know, I don't really know where I was going with the last part, but I'm in 100% agreement that it's not only a boost to his profile now, but, you know, it's also an anchor, you know, as he goes throughout his career, because, you know, if he's, you know, slumping offensively and, you know, whether it's this year at UCLA or inevitably as a pro, when he's going through it at the plate a little bit, you know, he's still going to be able to impact the game, and have his fingerprint, on what is hopefully a win for his club by, you know, defending his position really well and, you know, making the difficult play and, you know, being a leader on the field and then also in the dugout, which is what stands out with him a lot in listening to him talk and sort of how he goes about his business. Like, he's very wise beyond his years. And that was one of the reasons we were so high on UCLA coming into this season, is because not only is it an exceptional team from a talent standpoint, but in looking at the makeup of this year's team collectively, it's not, you know, you got guys like Rock Chulowski, Dean Lest, Vi LeVue. We could go on and on, but like, the leadership qualities really stand out. And I think that that is going to carry not only Rock, but a lot of those guys throughout their pro careers. But that's a long-winded way of saying yes, that his defense in and of itself is a real, real plus and a boost to his draft stock.
One of my favorite things to hear in the conversation, the conversations I've been having this fall, John Savage, head coach at UCLA, has said that he, Rock Chulowski, is very much like Brandon Crawford defensively. Brandon Crawford, of course, a four-time Gold Glove winner with the San Francisco Giants, one of the better defensive shortstops of the last, let's call it, decade in the major leagues, and also a UCLA alum. And so, you know, the quarterbacking shortstop comparisons have been you know, very active from Coach Savage, and those have been cool. So that is that's the story to watch this year in terms of who the top player in college baseball is. There's another profile that exists within the college game that I think is really important, and that is the college star, who is not necessarily the pro prospect. There are many examples of this. And by the way, this is not a bad thing. This is, teams need these kinds of players to be able to succeed. And I find that a lot of them come in the senior aged category. They are guys who are in their fourth or fifth year in college. They are experienced college hitters who have multiple years of starting under their belt. Maybe they're successful enough. Like, I'll give you an example, Bobby Boeser, who transfers from USF to Florida last year and then ends up on our All-American teams, and he goes pretty well in the draft. He looks like somebody who could play, you know, professional baseball for a long time. Was he a college superstar or a professional prospect going into his senior year? I would say he squarely fell into the former. He was a college producer, not necessarily a prospect. Within our fall ball all-star stories, we had a couple of examples of guys who I think enter their senior year in that category. So again, this is not to say that they can't go well in the draft after performance, but this is to say that we know they're going to be steady college producers who are going to elevate the floor for their team. One guy I want to talk about is Dallas Baptist second baseman Keaton Grady. He was one of the better contact first hitters in the country last season when he hit .366, four home runs, 14 doubles. He stole 18 bases with more walks than strikeouts. Bat-to-ball performance was outstanding, 92.7% zone contact rate, 84.4% overall contact rate. You couldn't really challenge him in the zone. He didn't swing and miss. And then this fall, according to head coach Dan Hefner, he has worked hard on consistently driving the ball in the air more after last year producing an 89.6 mile per hour average exit velocity. Peter, it's a two-parter again for you. I know I like to throw these your way. One, just speak to the college producer and how important that is for a team outside of professional prospects. And then second, what does a guy like Grady need to do to propel himself into reasonably solid draft status? There are tools here that I think are important in a professional prospect profile.
Yeah, I mean, I think to start, and you hit on it when talking about him, but you know, he's going to be, and he was, this was the case last spring too, when he hit over 360, but he'll be invaluable this year to Dallas Baptist and be kind of the straw that stirs the drink and sets the tone atop that lineup. And you know, he had 366 with 19 extra base hits, 25 RBIs, 18 bags, walked more than he struck out. So I mean, it's, you know, kind of a classic like slash and dash leadoff profile with Grady. He's a small, really small kid, 5'7", 170, I think he's listed at. Excellent bat to ball skills. Last year had a 93% in zone contact rate and an overall contact rate of just a shade under 85%. So, I mean, as far as a pro prospect goes, you're looking at someone who will be 23 before the season ends and is 5'7", minimal impact. So, I mean, not like the prettiest profile necessarily from a draft standpoint. But I mean, if he goes out and performs at a high level again for Dallas Baptist this year and does what he kind of almost, again, sort of replicates what he did last spring, it'll only serve him well. But I don't think that at this point that he's like a draft guy right now. But, you know, who knows if that'll change between now and July. And, you know, at least if I'm a team, like if he makes it through 20 rounds, you know, that's someone I'll throw sort of a free agent deal at and just get him in the org and see if the hit tool is going to play and sort of carry him throughout professional baseball. But I think for now that he fits in that bucket that, you know, you were talking about of, and it's a valuable one for college guys. And that's a really high level college performer. This is a guy that's going to be a huge key for Dallas Baptist this spring and, you know, potentially be their catalyst.
And I think that just goes to demonstrate, you know, the scope of the players that we're watching in college baseball, because you have guys like Rock Chalowski, who, you know, is going to captain a UCLA team that absolutely has national title hopes, that's probably going to open the season as our preseason number one. You know, and then he's also a tremendous multi-million dollar MLB draft prospect with a chance to go first overall. And yet you have a guy in Keaton Grady who hit for a better average last year than Rock Chalowski did, and has outstanding plate discipline. And he is going to be a seriously important factor, as you just said, whether that's because he's playing second base or shortstop, both of which seemingly are options for him going into the year. For a Dallas Baptist team, that is going to also be extremely competitive. That's the other thing. You know, Dallas Baptist has a chance to do some damage, maybe even to get to a super regional or beyond this season because of guys like Keaton Grady, who are not necessarily, as you said, in that pro prospect conversation, but are very much so at the top of the college game in a way that is meaningful. So an interesting little time. Holiday season is upon us, and if you're still searching for gifts, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen, like the MLB Perfect Catch coaster set, which can turn any table into a home run display. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone and every occasion. From moms and dads to kids and teens, from birthdays to the holidays to anniversaries, you'll find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes. With every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/BA2022. That's uncommongoods.com/BA2022 for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. Topic there. Here are five guys, though, Pete, that also fit both categories. All of them are on the mound, and it's setting up for a season in college baseball where we are going to see some outstanding pitching. And this is going to be at the mid-major level, of course, at the high-major level. And then those guys are going to go really well in the draft. The big five to me, starting pitcher-wise, going into the season, are Liam Peterson at Florida, Cameron Flukie at Coastal Carolina, Jackson Flora at UC Santa Barbara, Tommy Lepore at TCU, and then the X factor of the big five is Joey Volchko, right-hander who transferred from Stanford to Georgia this offseason. Those guys can kind of dictate the pace for their teams this year. If they live up to the true ace potential, I think that every single one of the teams I just mentioned has the ingredients, if they can put them all together, to make a very deep run. If these guys struggle, it dramatically impacts the ceiling and floor for all five of those teams. What do you got on this year's big five on the mound? This feels like a really advanced group relative to most years.
Yeah, no pun intended. You know, it'll be a very fun arms race to see, you know, who ends up being the first pitcher off the board in July. And Carlos and I talked about it last week on the draft podcast, and we went pretty in-depth on four of them. The only guy we didn't touch on was Tommy Lepore. And I think if you're looking for sort of a dark horse, and I mentioned it as well, but Ryan Lynch from North Carolina is someone I have my eyes on. Now, like, when all is said and done, is he going to be the first starting pitcher off the board? Like, I'd be shocked. But I mean, if he pitches his way into the first round, by the end of the season, I wouldn't be totally blown away at all. But anyways, with the five that you mentioned, all five are needless to say, really talented arms. But I think when whittling it down further in that quartet of even that trio, really, of Jackson Flora, Cameron Flukie, and Liam Peterson, each arm has, you know, unique traits that makes it, you know, I guess that separates it from itself, themselves from one another, and, you know, sort of makes it special. And, you know, I guess to circle way back, like, Joey Volchko is going to be probably a really polarizing guy and has already been a polarizing prospect throughout this year's draft cycle, because from a stuff standpoint, he is unmatched. But there is a big if as to whether or not he's going to be able to compete in and around the zone enough on a consistent enough basis and throw enough quality strikes to take that next step forward. performance wise, it does sound like, and you wrote about it in great detail, that, you know, there were some positive adjustments made this fall, both in terms of his delivery, changing up some of the shapes of his pitches, and grips. But I got to see him go out and do it in the spring. But with Flora, Flukie, and Peterson, you know, that's quite the trio and a fun one to watch. And each of those three guys is, they're going to headline their respective teams' rotations. And, you know, with Flukie and Flora especially, and especially Flukie, like, it's a really exciting combination of strikes and also high-end stuff. And I think that Flukie is probably the best of those three when it comes to that, in that regard. But, you know, each of those guys, Flora, Flukie, and Peterson, have a real argument at this point to be the first pitcher off the board. And I said it last week on the draft podcast, like, by the skin of his teeth, I'd probably go with Cam Flukie as my starting pitcher number one at this point. But, you know, that's going to, I'll probably wrestle with that, and it'll change in my mind a few times throughout the year. But, you know, outside of those, the four guys or five guys, it'll be, I'm kind of interested to see if anyone emerges and thrust themselves into that conversation. Cause I feel like inevitably it happens every year, but I think that, you know, I'd be a little surprised if at the end of the day, one of Cameron Flukie, Jackson Flora, or Liam Peterson isn't the first college arm off the board.
You mentioned it. There is a group outside of that big five, if you want to call it that, that is outstanding on the mound this year on the college side. You said Ryan Lynch, Jason DeCaro, Cole Carlone at Arizona State, Aiden Canock at Clemson, Trey Beard at Florida State has gotten a lot of really positive fall feedback. Ricky Ojeda, UC Irvine, Blake Morningstar, Wake Forest, all of these guys are firmly within the top 100 and are going to have a chance to elevate their status with performance. A few of the guys who I just mentioned made some really important changes mechanically, which, by the way, a lot of them you can read about over at baseballamerica.com, that are going to impact their ceiling for this upcoming season as they continue to be evaluated. And if I could just stake my claim at this point in the year, on a pitcher, and you'll have to tell me how dramatically in the minority group I stand right now. I think my SP1 going into the season is Jackson Flora. I'm so impressed with the potential there. It's a heater up to 100. They made changes to the grip, so some of the dead zone characteristics that plagued that fastball, especially against left-handed hitters last year, have been eliminated. He's getting more consistent carry on it up in the zone. They added a slurvy curveball that fits right between his slider and sweeper. They added a kick changeup that has seemingly been outstanding. I had one evaluator tell me that it was comfortably a 60 right now, with the potential to be even better by the end of the year. We're talking about a high-octane, lower-slot, right-handed starter who's going to pitch in a conference that I think he should be able to dominate. I have a hard time seeing Jackson Flora not pitching his way very aggressively into the conversation to be the first starting pitcher off the board.
Yeah, I mean, I think that most people that you talk to at this point probably have Liam Peterson or Cameron Flukie as like their number one pitcher, but you could pretty easily argue Jackson Flora, and you just did it. Like, those are the key points to hit on. And I think that, you know, outside of the stuff, which is really impressive, like, you're talking about a 6'5", like 205 pound kid who can probably continue to fill out and get a little bit more physical and stronger throughout. And that'll only serve him well. And, you know, the dynamism of his arsenal. But, you know, he's up to 100 from this really low slot. And, you know, his fastball plays really well up in the zone. And it sounds like this fall that, you know, they ironed out the fastball grip and shape for him to be able to sustain that kind of effectiveness with his heater, not only as the game goes on, but as the season goes on as well. And he pairs it primarily with a plus sweeper. And I think the wild card for me and a lot of people is going to be seeing how this, refined arsenal, you could call it, looks in the spring, like, how, like, because he's been working on this kick change It's kind of been under construction since like last spring, and it sounds like this year is going to be the.
Well, actually, can I talk about that for a second?
Yeah,
so I had a really interesting conversation with Andrew Checkitz about that changeup. Little known, but last year he was trying to throw a splitter, and they only started really working on the kick changeup this offseason in a serious way because he decided the split that he was throwing last year was not working for him at all. And so they instituted this new changeup, and it is a new grip now. It's not the same thing that he was trying to throw last year. They are two different changeups, which I think is interesting. So to your point, yes, he is refining it, but this is even newer than the last changeup that people saw at the end of the spring last year.
Yeah, that's great intel. And I think that, you know, I'll be interested to see how it looks and if that's a viable third pitch that he's able to get left-handed hitters out with, and if it turns into a real swing and miss offering. And it sounds like this fall it looked the part of exactly that. And if he's able to carry that over into the spring, that's obviously going to serve him well, because right now he's largely a two-pitch guy, and then it sounds like the slurvy curveball is just going to be a fourth kind of show pitch. But you know, he's a 6'5" somewhat projectable arm with already loud now stuff. He commands the baseball well. You could certainly argue for him to be the first pitcher off the board if that's your cup of tea.
We're going to end the show here with some team superlatives. I'm actually going to kick this one off because it ties directly to what I was just talking about. We're starting with sneaky rotation, Peter. This is a Division I rotation that you think has the ability to surprise some people or stand out maybe a little bit more from the shadows than some of these top teams. Mine is UCSB, of course, in large part because it's fronted by who I believe, as I just said, to be the top starting pitcher in college baseball entering the year from a draft standpoint. I do think that they made refinements that are going to allow a guy who, by the way, really didn't need to refine too much. I mean, you look at the numbers from last year. This was a very productive sophomore starting pitcher for the Gauchos. Now I think he'll be even better and more mature. He's facing the same hitters who he largely dominated last year, especially towards the end of the season. But then you go behind him, and they have prospects, draft prospects, who will fill out that rotation. And I don't know how many college teams are trotting out three roughly top 100 to top 200 starting pitchers in this year's draft from Friday to Sunday. They start with Flora. They're probably going to go to lefty Cole Triba on Saturdays. He's a fringe top 100 prospect for us. I actually think he has a chance to crack the top 100 in our next update. And then Calvin Prosky closes out their rotation. And he's somebody who I think has done a lot of positive work for himself this offseason and maybe is positioning himself to enter the spring as a, let's say, top 5th to 7th round pitcher in the upcoming draft. I really like where this Gauchos rotation stands heading into the year.
Yeah, I mean, pitching's been the name of the game and kind of the strength for UCSB for what seems like a number of years now. So, I mean, it feels like we say this ahead of every season and, you know, as we get into the postseason even more, but, you know, how much they hit is like the big X factor with them. And is, you know, sort of, I guess I'm trying to phrase this the right way. It'll determine their ceiling a little bit, but man, that rotation, you know, you're going to win a lot of games. You're going to win a lot of series with those three guys as your three headed monster on weekends. Cause that's, you know, that's as good of a group as you'll find out West, and, you know, they'll be able to pitch with and against anyone probably in the country. But I guess for my sleeper rotation, not to jump into it prematurely, but again, this is not a sleeper because they're the furthest thing from a sleeper team and they were in the College World Series final last year. But Coastal Carolina, the 1-2 punch of Cameron Flukey and presumably Hayden Johnson, who is sort of like the X factor and pushed it over the goal line for me. You know, that's also like, you know, you talk about winning a lot of games. Like Cameron Flukey is Cameron Flukey. We've talked about him at length at this point, not only in today's show, but on other podcasts. But Hayden Johnson is someone that I dove into last week. Was excellent in relief last year for Coastal Carolina. It sounds like he's going to make the jump into the rotation. Really exciting stuff. Exciting fastball traits. Slider will really flash, and so will his curveball. And it's from a tough angle on the left side, especially for left-handed hitters. But you know, I think we emphasize it a lot, maybe even once an episode. But like Coastal last year and going to the College World Series final, like they're not going to go to the College World Series final and like kind of pull this disappearing act, so to speak, this year. Like they're here to stay. And that's not me saying like they're a lock to get back to Omaha and a lock to get back to being in the College World Series final, but they're going to be really, really competitive again this year in 2026. And it's going to start on the mound, which is interesting because it's kind of a change of tune from, you know, what was sort of the Coastal Carolina brand, even until like the early part of the 2020s, which was like, this is a team that is going to really be able to hit and beat you with its bats. Who knows how much they're going to be able to pitch, but good luck trying to out hit and out slug them, especially at their home ballpark, which is a launch pad. But in the past couple of years, the tune has totally switched. To not like to the point where the offense is anemic, but like the pitching is without a doubt the team's biggest strength, and that holds true as we look towards 2026 as well. They've still got some good pieces, both returning and incoming offensively, who will make that lineup go. But again, the pitching is the strength of this year's Coastal team, and a huge credit to coaches Schnall and Williams and the rest of the coaching staff for ironing that operation out.
No doubt. Let us advance. I'll go back to you. We'll snake draft this. Peter, best rotation. Let me just be clear. Sneaky rotation and best rotation, what's the difference? Coastal Carolina absolutely could have the best rotation in the country, as could UCSB. Best rotation and best lineup are more geared towards like, who do we know is good right now? Go ahead. Sorry about that.
No, that's an important disclaimer because like, depending on how you bend it and define it, you could really like say this team is the like best rotation, and then this team is also the sleeper rotation. So like somewhat interchangeable. But for me, the best rotation, at least right now, and it has to do with the 1-2 punch sort of deal, I really like the UNC duo of Ryan Lynch and nice. Jason DeCaro. Like as far as draft status is concerned, those are two guys. You know, Ryan Lynch is, we've talked about him on this podcast, he's got first round upside, and Jason DeCaro will go in a prominent spot as well. But you know, it's a really good group, and Ryan Lynch especially. I mean, he's got this pretty hellacious 1-2 punch and sort of east-west profile, a little a la Jackson Flora, just in terms of the like being a two-pitch guy with the fastball and sweeper. We don't need to get too into the weeds here, but he also is a guy that sounds like he's worked on a third pitch and a changeup that'll help him out against left-handed hitters. And seeing him make the jump into the rotation full-time and presumably headline that UNC rotation, it'll be interesting to see what he does, because last year he was just a true freshman, and outside of I believe like three starts, he made all of his appearances in relief. So I'll be curious to see how the stuff holds up throughout multiple trips through the lineup, throughout the duration of a game and whatnot. Those are some things that I'm kind of curious about with Lynch. But with Jason DeCaro, I mean, he's been pitching in UNC's weekend rotation not only since he was a true freshman, but he was 17 for most of the spring. So he'll still be, you know, he'll just turn 20 in the lead up to the draft. And, you know, he can command the baseball. It'll be interesting to see what the quality of the stuff looks like, especially the quality of the fastball. But, you know, he's got a handful of distinct shapes, has the look of a starter, is, you know, this 6'5", high-waisted right-hander, prototypical pitcher's build. You know, so I think that's a really, really formidable duo in the ACC.
I go to Gainesville for my best rotation. That group's going to be tough to beat. Liam Peterson, obviously we talked about him on this show, is the number one prospect on the mound in our draft rankings at the moment. Can that change? Yes. But right now he is number one. Super unique release traits. He's got this really high release height from which he has a pretty awesome east-west. I almost said the exact opposite thing. Really great north-south attack. Fastball got better. He added a two-seamer this fall that has been apparently good, even though it's more of a change of pace offering that he's going to be able to work against lefties a little bit better and in on the hands of righties. He's got a really good slider. The changeup is flash plus. There are a lot of evaluators who think that the curveball just hasn't been thrown enough, but is a potential plus pitch. And having that at the front of your rotation is obviously huge. It's the sophomore and Saturday starter, though, Aiden King, who I think is the real name to be paying attention to. Is he the top pitcher in his class in 2027? No, that belongs to Dax Whitney. But this is, a really good sophomore starting pitcher. He was outstanding last year, a freshman All-American, and he's just super mature. So the makeup is great. I think he'll be able to go out and do it again. Great 1-2 punch. And you got Russell Sandifer, the Sunday starter, who's a top 150 to 200-ish prospect in this upcoming draft, transfer from UCF. He looked pretty good this fall, is a better strike thrower than I think anybody on the staff that has a chance to be in the weekend rotation. So, and Luke McNeely, is another right-handed pitcher who has good data. And if he can kind of put it all together and be more consistent, he also has some great upside for this upcoming draft. So Florida is my best rotation. Sneaky lineup. Remember, we're snaking, so I'm going to kick this one off. This one might not be so quote-unquote sneaky just because this is a very prominent team. But just the nature of their 2025 season makes me think that they fit this category fine, and that's Texas A&M. They had a really good offseason in the transfer portal. You bring in a guy like Wesley Jordan, Chris Hakopian. Both are known producers at the college level. Then you bring back a healthy Caden Sorrell, a healthy Gavin Grahovic, and this is a team that's looking like it has a chance to do a whole lot of damage at the plate, and it's going to need to. They are going to be under the microscope this year. From their own fan base and on the national side, just because last year was such an underachieving season. They opened the year number one. They don't even make the tournament, first team since Arizona State in the 90s to do both of those things. And this lineup, I think, has a chance to kind of boost them back to where they expect to be. Does that make them a national title contender? Probably not. Does it make them a team that can host or make a little bit of noise toward the top of the SEC? I do think so, and I also do believe, because I've seen it over the course of years, Michael Early is a good hitting coach. He's been regarded as that since his days working with Spencer Torkelson and Hunter Bishop at Arizona State, and so I do think he's going to get these guys in a position to hit. I like this lineup. What say you about A&M, and then your pick for sneaky lineup?
Yeah, we've said it since the end of last year, which, not to mince words, was a disaster, but this is a put up or shut up year, for a lot of reasons in College Station. So it'll be interesting to see how everyone rises to the occasion, but they certainly have the talent, just as they did last year, to make a lot of noise, and especially offensively, with that four-headed monster, you want to call it, with Chris Hakopian, Caden Sorrell, Gavin Grahovic, Terrence Keel. And then you've got other pieces in there. It's go time. I mean, this is a big year. So, they again will be, sort of for the total opposite reasons as last year, they will be a team to watch very closely. But the sort of sleeper lineup that I have, and I apologize to the listener, because these aren't like crazy deep pulls, at least not yet. As the season goes on, we'll revisit and get more into the weeds. But this is another team. It feels like we say it every year. Like, we speak in hypotheticals with them, but Arizona State's lineup is again a group that I'm I'm pretty bullish on. It's a pretty exciting blend of guys that they've got coming back. Obviously freshman Landon Harrison, who was excellent last year, hit over 330 with 17 extra base hits. I mean, he can he can really, really swing it. You know, he's not draft eligible until 2027, but, you know, as far as bats go in that draft class, I mean, he's a really complete and well-rounded hitter. And it makes sense just with, you know, being a Harrison in baseball in his blood, but he hit the ground running last year and he'll be back and sort of leading the attack. They've got new Contreras, who's back again and should hopefully slash finally be, you know, fully healthy and can put together a full season. But he was also productive last year. And then in the portal, they went and got three guys in particular, who I think are going to be high impact guys, Dean Toigo. And this was someone that you wrote about, but I think, you know, he hit almost 380 last year at UNLV with 18 homers. He's a big 6'4" left-handed hitter. You know, I think that that profile is going to play really, really well at ASU and in that yard where the ball tends to fly a little bit. So, I mean, he's a middle of the order bat. Dominic Longo in a similar breath, another guy that they went out and got from the transfer portal. He went to Utah Valley, 6'3" kid, physical, another one over 30 extra base hits last year, stole 22 bases, fun tools with him. And then PJ Mutsaritis swung the bat well at Cal, can really, really defend at shortstop, is a great anchor to have up the middle. So, I mean, like when we're looking at ASU up the middle, they've got Brody Briggs behind the plate who can defend. They've got PJ Mutsaritis at shortstop who can really defend. We'll see what they do in the outfield with Isaiah Jackson now on a professional baseball. But, you know, catcher and shortstop, you've got two of the three taken care of. And then, you know, Dominic Smaldino, a huge, like physically massive kid. I think he's 6'6 or 6'7. Came over from Cal Berkeley with PJ. He hit really well this fall. And then the X factor to keep your eye on is Beckett Zvorek. Had just 26 at bats last year, went 10 for 26. I mean, in a small sample, that's about as good as you can get. But he went to the Northwoods and continued to just flat out rake. He hit 360, you know, went across a 111 at bat sample, stole 28 bases in as many games. Almost ran an almost 1-to-1 K to walk ratio, like typical, like top of the order leadoff profile, hitterish look in the box with really good bat to ball skills. Can really run and impact the game with his legs, not only, you know, on the base paths as well, and put pressure on opposing defenses, but, you know, the bat to ball ability with Zvorek and just hitterish tendencies stand out. So, as you can tell by my long-winded answer for anyone listening to this, like, it's a really deep lineup. Again, there are some like unknowns with how the mid-major guys are going to perform as they make the step up and make the leap from sort of these smaller schools into the Big 12. But man, like the pieces are there for them to really hit again. And then on the mound, you know, Cole Carlone, 6'5", 6'6", left-handed starter, is going to headline the rotation. So again, ASU is in the bucket of, like, if, you know, we're sitting here in May or June talking about them hosting, like, I wouldn't really be all that surprised. But the biggest key for them and what's kind of been the struggle in the last handful of years is, like, they've got to go out and do it, and they've got to be able to put it all together and actually perform. So we'll see if they do it, but the pieces are certainly there for them to have a really exciting season.
No, for sure. I mean, we could even rebrand the sneaky lineup category to the lineups that have something to prove, you know, for the sake of their coaching stability at their schools. Because if neither of those offenses do what they need to do, it could be tough sledding for Coach Early and Coach Bloomquist. Both guys, I think, enter the season a little bit on the hot seat in a year of judgment. I'm just going to speak for both of us on this one here, Pete, because if I remember correctly, your best lineup and my best lineup align, and we've talked about it already on the show. That belongs to UCLA. Brock Chalowski at the top of the lineup does a ton for you. He's somebody who's going to carry this team. We talked about why earlier in the show. You can go back if you need to hear it again, but he is outstanding. Dean West is back. Mulevi Levu is back. You can, I mean, literally, you can go through top to bottom in their lineup, and it is filled with returners. They add just a couple of players who I think have a chance to make an impact this offseason, some of them on the freshman side. They also didn't really have a very active transfer portal season because this is a team that is extremely well stocked with talent. And just the returning depth here for us is what sets them apart. So you have the top end player, you have the supporting cast. This is a lineup that is just simply stacked. Anything you want to say on the Bruins here, Pete?
You hit the nail on the head, but in terms of like us not having the same lineup, I was going to go in a different direction and mention Georgia Tech, who I think is, you know, also deserving of being mentioned in this conversation. You know, and for really good reason, like last year they had an awesome year, won the ACC regular season title for, I think the first time since 1999, maybe. That might be too aggressive of a leap, but they won the ACC regular season title for the first time in a little bit. Like from a production standpoint and who they return, like, man, oh man, like they returned Drew Burris, who will be a Golden Spikes candidate, perhaps a Golden Spikes finalist. If all goes well, he hit 19 homers again last year. They returned Kent Schmidt, who missed some time, but hit just a shade under 400 at 397, more like doubles power than home run power, but sort of like an interesting profile in that he's a first baseman and no doubt like hit over power, can spray the baseball from foul line to foul line. Von Lackey and Alex Hernandez, who hit 347 and 335 respectively, are both back as well. Hernandez hit 16 homers, like can hammer the baseball to all fields, is one of the more impressive. Well, he's one of the more impressive sophomore eligible bats in this year's class. Positionally, it's a little more muddy, but, you know, and then Von Lackey, you know, he swung it really well last year, super athletic catcher behind the plate plus arm. And then also in the portal, they went out and got Jaron Advincula, who's like a personal cheese ball of mine in this year's draft class. You know, we talk about the catalysts and X factors at the top of the order. Like he's going to make that whole operation go at the top of the lineup, like plus hitter for me. Excellent barrel skills, can really run, competitive as all get out. Like, he is going to serve that team so well, both from a tool standpoint and then also like outside of the white lines, a leadership and makeup standpoint, because he is as competitive a kid as you will find. And then they also went out and got Ryan Zuckerman from Pitt, who's a, you know, big and physical corner infielder over at third base, who's a no doubt like power over hit guy. But like, I think that, you know, his offensive profile is going to play really well at Russ Chandler. And then they return, you know, other players like Caleb Daniel and Carson Kurse, who hit over 300, and Carson Kurse had 20 doubles. So like, that's nine guys right there who you can feel really confident in producing and swinging the bat at a really high level. Like, I think if any team in America had even just one of these nine guys in their lineup, they'd be really excited. Like someone like Drew Burris or Alex Hernandez or Von Lackey or Jaron or Kent Schmidt, who can kind of be your headliner and centerpiece. Like, you know, that's all well and good, but you know, you've got at least five centerpieces in your one lineup with a handful of, I think, really impressive guys who will make up your support and cast. And like, man, not to set too high of an expectation for Georgia Tech, but I am really, really excited to watch them go out and do it in the spring and swing it. Cause like, good Lord, see, like trying to navigate that lineup as an opposing pitching staff, like, and like trying to map out, like, how are you going to get these guys out 27 times and win those 27 outs? Like, it's going to be really, really difficult. So for that reason and a lot more, like, I think Georgia Tech is an Omaha team, but yeah, they're my most impressive lineup.
Well, if this doesn't get you excited for the college season, I really don't know what does. We are itching to get to that point. A couple things to keep your eye out for over the next couple of weeks and even into the next month-ish. So into 2026 we go. The Baseball America Prospect Handbook is currently being produced. We're excited to get that out. Make sure you head on over to the site to get yourself one of those. You can bundle all of our books together, and it is worth it if you are truly a diehard baseball fan. And then on the website size at baseballamerica.com, we got top 10s coming out, a lot of former college players. You can keep tabs on them and how they're doing as pros, soon top 30s. On the college side, we are, like we said earlier, approaching the ABCA meetings. We will have details of what to expect from that coming up soon. We just closed out a series of fall standouts, of data standouts heading into 2026. Peter has done a lot of work on the draft side to cover some mid-major guys that you should be keeping an eye on who are eligible in 2026. We will reasonably soon, before you know it, have top 25 details coming out on the site. The 2026 season is basically here, folks, and it feels like it's still a little bit of a ways away with Christmas still ahead of us and the new year still ahead of us, but we have arrived. I mean, it is 2026 time. So again, keep your eye out on baseballamerica.com. Find us in print as well over the course of the next couple months. Baseball America College Magazine is the other thing I forgot to mention that is coming out early next year. So all great stuff over at BA. And for Peter Flaherty, I'm Jacob Rudner. For the second to last time in 2025, this is the College Podcast, and we'll see you next time.